Shall we start, please? So, excuse me, today's lecture is gonna be in English, okay? I hope it's okay for all of us. If at any point you have questions, either on what we are doing or about some English word you don't understand or I said wrong or whatever, please just interrupt me and ask me. If you don't want to ask me in English, try in German slowly, I might understand. And if I don't, I'm sure a couple of you will be able to translate it for me, so everything should be fine. First thing in the agenda, of course, will be the registration for the exercises we had yesterday and the day before. It was, of course, a mess for all of us. So the first thing I'd like to do is apologize for that. If we had known that Studon was going to behave the way it did, of course, we would have tried some other thing. This situation with the system, which was unresponsive most of the time, turned out to generate three kinds of problems, which I will now enumerate and we will try to solve somehow. So there were three kind of problems. First, some of you, by the time you were able to access the system, find out that there were no more slots, no more vacancies. And that was because we couldn't even enter to change and increase the number of vacancies in time. So I know that some of you couldn't register to any Übung whatsoever. So just to have an idea, how many of you are in that situation? Could you raise your hand? Okay, good. There was a second problem, which was as follows. We realized about half an hour before the registration period started that there were some inconsistencies between what said in Studon and what was in Unibis on in our homepage. What was wrong was what was in Studon, okay? We tried to fix it before the registration period started, but we couldn't. And we tried to do it short after it started because we said, okay, maybe a couple of people did it wrong, so then we can fix it, and we couldn't as well. We could only fix it yesterday in the afternoon. So it may be the case, this is the second problem, that many of you registered to one group, believing that you were registering to one group and you were actually registering to another one. The groups with these problems were, well, there was one announced for Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Using slider is Dorsch. And of course, we discussed that this slot was not available. So here it was meant to mean Thursdays, okay? So if you registered in this one, well, maybe you thought it was going to be the one at 10 in the morning. Well, no, it was going to be this one. And then there were two more. The one that said Tuesday 4:15 and Thursday 4:15, one said here Litak, and the other one said Gorin. So these were interchanged. So if you register to this one, expecting to get here, it was wrong, and the other way around. This case is not so problematic because we just essentially swap those who misregistered. So we put a warning message in the webpage of the course, but I don't know if you were able to see it in time. So now my question is just to have an idea is, now that you know this, how many of you realize that are in this situation? Okay, excellent. So this is a non-problem. I realize that there might be someone not here that... So at some point you should go back to student and check that you did this all right. And there's, of course, a third issue, which, oh, yes. Yes, if you tell me how, I will be happy to do it. I've never been in this classroom before, so I don't know. Better? Okay. So there's, of course, a third case, which I consider valid, is the case where some of you tried very early to register to the group you wanted. You wanted to do it early so you get a place, and then you couldn't access the system, and you've been retrying for hours, and by the time you managed to do it, you find some vacancies, but not where you wanted. So this is a third case, and you just had to pick whatever was available. So again, just to get an idea, how many of you are in this situation? Okay. So here is more or less what we are going to do. We have the possibility of opening one more group on Mondays. Okay. Is Monday a good day for... So now the question is, how many of you, just to get an idea, would be willing to change to a group on Mondays? Okay, good. So how many of you would be willing to move to Monday at 4? Okay. Monday is at what time do you think it's good for? So is so it's twelve. Okay. So. How many would be willing to move to a group on at Mondays at 12? Okay. Those who raised your hands are not already on Mondays at 12, right? Good. Okay, so we will add a new one on Mondays at 12. And this is what we are going to do. Those of you who want to change, I mean, I don't want to go through student again for this, so we are going to do this. Those of you who want to change your current registration for whatever of the reasons I already mentioned, because, well, either you don't have to, you don't change, but you don't have a group whatsoever, or you have a group, but you would rather move to the one on Mondays, or you have a group, but you would rather move to some other group for which we will probably have place now because many people is going to Mondays. Just send me an email. My email, you can find it if you first go to our homepage, course page, and just click on my name. Do it, please, today. And I will try to solve it during the weekend and come back to you saying, okay, what's the group where you finally are? It's okay. Those of you who don't send me an email, you just can assume that you are in the group where you have already registered and everything is okay. Yes? The new group will be in German. More questions? Good. Ah, please, in the email you send me, please include in which group you are currently are. Otherwise, I have to track this, and it may take time. It's okay? Okay. So, any other administrative question before we start? Good. The things we are going to discuss today, as well as those things you saw last class on Wednesday, you can find them on chapter one of the Melchor and Sanders book that was mentioned in the bibliography on Wednesday, which you can get online if you want. So let's do a brief recapitulation about what you saw on Wednesday. So essentially, two things were discussed. We looked at counting operations on very simple algorithms. In fact, they are the first algorithms you ever learned, probably by a time where you didn't know what the word algorithm meant, which are the addition of two numbers and the multiplication of two numbers, natural numbers, as you learn them in school. And so we wrote a pseudocode for the algorithms, and we counted how many operations, how many primitive operations are needed to compute the result, assuming that the input have both n digits. And the primitive operations that we were using were addition of three digits and multiplication of two digits. The results we had, so this is just I'm copying what was done last Wednesday, was that addition of two n-digit natural numbers requires n primitive operations. Okay, this was the first thing done, and the second one was the following multiplication of two n-digit natural numbers requires, I think it was 3n plus something, 2n plus, yeah, 3n squared plus 2n. Okay, do you remember seeing that? So the next natural question you should ask yourselves at this point is, okay, so what? I mean, why do we care about this? So why do we care about addition and multiplication? It's just because they are simple examples of algorithms. We want to show the idea in counting operations. But OK, so here we have n, and here we have 3n squared plus 2n. So what does this tell us? So one first observation one needs to do is, okay, what does it mean? So let's say we count operations on numbers which are increasingly larger, more and more digits. What will we observe? And let's say that an is a number of primitive operations to compute addition with n digits, and let's say that m sub n is the same for multiplication. Okay, so we have we use that notation, and let's say that we look at how many operations we need to perform for addition when we have two n digits, and we compare it with how many we need when we have only n digits. So let's see what happens when we double the size of the input. Okay. Let's just use the definitions we have. This is essentially simple. So here we need two times n operations because of that, and here we need n operations. Here we need two n operations. Okay, so we have two n digits, and we need linearly many digits. So here we need two n operations. Okay, all agree. In the second case, we need n operations. I'm just replacing the definition in the theorem. So what we get is two. And this was a very simple observation. And we have essentially for the identity function, if we double the size of the input, we double the size of operations needed. This is simple observation. But let's compare and see what happens when we do multiplication instead. So here we would have we need to compare the quotient between the multiplication with 2n operations and the multiplication with n operations. And so here we do what? We replace this expression here. We replace n by 2n. And we get something like this. And here we just copy what we have there. 3n squared plus 2n, okay? And then we observe the following. This here is, this term here is 4n squared, okay? And this thing here is 4n, okay? So I will divide this expression by 4n squared. It's just getting a common sub-expression. So here we get 3. I've extracted this 4n squared from here. And here we get what? 1 over n. Okay, we divide here by 4n squared, and we get an n here dividing. And here on the other hand, we have the same thing. 3. In this case, I extract n squared. Okay, so we get 3 plus 2 over n. And now what do we have? We compare these things here and observe that as n gets larger and larger, these things get closer to 0 and closer to 0. So these numbers, this and this, are essentially the same. And we conclude that this is more or less 4 for large n. Okay. So this means that in the first case, when we double the input, we just double the number of operations. But here, when we double the size of the input, we need to multiply by 4 the number of operations. So if instead of doubling the input, we were quadrupling the input, here we would be quadrupling the number of operations, and here multiplying it by 16. So this gives us more or less an idea that multiplication seems to be worse, requires much more operations than addition, and that we will clearly see this once we start considering multiplications and additions of large numbers for large values of n. Okay? So this is the first thing one can conclude. But now there's a second thing that if I were you, I would object. And I would say, okay, so we are counting here simple additions and simple multiplications. Those are our trivial operations. But what are so special about them? When we actually need to perform the addition of n-digit numbers or multiplication of n-digit numbers, we need to do more stuff, not only additions and simple additions and multiplications of digits. We also need to align stuff properly, remember to iterate correctly, etc. So why are we focusing only on these two operations? Why not count everything we do? Okay, that's, I think, a sensible question. I can offer you two answers. The second one is the one I'm most interested, but the first one is interesting as well. So first one would say that maybe this these primitive operations, addition of two digits, multiplication of two digits, are in fact the complex operations in this algorithm. So if you remember when you were a child and you had to do these operations, they gave you homework with multiplication of two long numbers, and the part, well, I don't know you, but the part that for me was taking the steps that required me time was multiplying two digits and remembering the multiplication tables, etc. Aligning things properly were no brainers. I just knew how to do it. But the other ones, I need to spend some time. So we could say that, for instance, here we are counting the cognitive complexity of the algorithm in that case. We are counting only operations that we know are especially difficult or take longer than the others. That's one possible answer, but it's not the one. It's not the reason why they interest us. The reason why they interest us is the following. They give us a simple model of the algorithm. So it's an abstraction of all the things we are doing, and we expect it to be a good model, a good simplification. So it's good for us, the simplification. We need to count less operations, less things to worry about. But since it is a model, we expect that we can somehow extrapolate the results from the model to the real life. And here's what one can do for this. Let's say that you now go home and you open your favorite editor and start implementing these very simple algorithms. You pick your favorite language, let's say Java, whatever, if that's your favorite language, I don't know, and you start implementing it. Once you try to do that, you will have to fill in a lot of details. So you will have to decide, okay, what is a natural number now in this setting? It will be an array, for instance, array of something. You can probably, if you want to do it in a tidy way, you may define one method for the primitive addition and one method for primitive multiplication, and be sure to always use that. But also you will have to decide, I don't know, how you iterate through the digits, if you will use an auxiliary counter variable, or if you will use some iterator class that is provided to you or whatever. You solve all those issues and you get a program, okay? And then at least one could say that if your implementation of the algorithm was faithful to the pseudocode we discussed, then at least those results there will agree with your implementation in the sense that it will be true that adding two natural numbers in your implementation requires n calls to your primitive addition method and requires, for multiplication, it will require 3n squared plus 2n calls to one of your primitive addition or multiplication methods, okay? So in that sense, that will be still correct. Now you may ask, yeah, well, but so what? If I run my program, there will be lots of things going on. Other variables will be incremented and stuff will done on it because I need to implement the iteration and we have overhead for method invocations and stuff needs to be moved from memory where the arrays are to registers and move back. All those things take times, are operations, and we are just ignoring them here. But the way to look at it is that it's not really that we care about the specific primitive additions or multiplications, but that instead all the extra things the program will have to do, loading data from memory, etc., the number of processor instructions needed to do that will be more or less the same every time we add two numbers, every time we use a primitive addition operation or every time we use a primitive multiplication operation. So one can say that we are in fact we are not really want to count these operations per se, but as a unit of work that will have to be done, okay? And in that sense, This result here predicts that if you measure the time your implementation in Java needs to sum two n-digit numbers or multiply two n-digit numbers, the total running time will be in a way described by a quadratic function or a linear function. That's the way we need to read this. Of course, you don't need to believe this. Okay, so yeah, you say this is a prediction of what will happen, but I mean, what if the prediction is wrong? So you actually shouldn't believe this. You should go home and try to write the programs and run it and test them and measure how long they take. And you may find numbers like this. So I'm just going to build a small table. So this is a table with results, actual results that someone took from an implementation of multiplication. And what he did was run his implementation for increasing number of digits. So let's say it was run for multiplying eight digit numbers, 16, 32, 64, 128, whatever, until he got bored. This is something you can do at home as well. And it was for each of these cases, it was measured how long it took for the program to finish in milliseconds. That's a simple experiment you can do. The results of this concrete experiment were numbers like this. Oh yeah, I forgot. Okay, I don't know. It's a table full of numbers. When I see it, my first reaction is exactly that. It's a table full of numbers. So what? And yeah, okay. So when n grows, the numbers grow as well. Yeah, okay. But then you can do the following observation. Let's add a column to the table, right? Where we add the quotient between the time required for executing the problem on something of size n and the size and the time required for solving it for size n over 2, or what's the same 2n and n as you want to write it, okay? And then we get interesting numbers. Look. And if we have more values, it would go on. So what are these numbers? If we look at them, they are getting closer and closer to 4. Okay? The difference with 4 is getting smaller all the time. And if we run it for longer examples, we will observe that these numbers are all the time near 4. Where have we seen a 4 before? Recently. And that's strange, right? Why should they agree? Well, the idea is that the first thing to notice is that if you repeat that operations there, that quotient between two quadratic polynomials, for any quadratic polynomial, you will get more or less the same results. You will always get that every time you double the size of the input and you take the quotient, the number converges to 4 for large values of n. Because essentially, the important part is that we get this 4 n squared from here. And every time we divide by 4 n squared, we get things over n here. So for whatever quadratic polynomial you try, this operation, you will get that the quotient always tends to 4 in the limit. And what that means is that the running time of this algorithm is described also by a quadratic equation. This is, or this can be accurately described by a quadratic equation. So it is true that we can, at least for this example, extrapolate and see these results as a prediction of actual running time of an algorithm. Of course, one should ask at this point is, well, but can we use any selection of primitive operations for this? No. So we will always count only some operations. We will use some abstraction. We expect this abstraction to be good, but we should always be paying attention on whether we are assuming something that is not correct. So if there are some hidden operation which we think that is not accounted for by these primitive operations we decide to use. It's okay? Get more or less the idea? Okay, having gone through this, let's try to look at another problem. All the example of the algorithms we considered were essentially iterative. Okay, so let's look at a recursive algorithm, just to try to see how we can then count operations on it. And let's consider, for instance, a recursive version of the school multiplication. Yeah, this will be a little, we'll be doing additions and multiplications for a little while, but let's consider this problem. How can we find a nice recursive algorithm for this problem? And what we will do is based on this basic observation. Let's say we have some number, I don't know, 7, 2, 3, 9, 4, 5, 2, 1. Which, if I copy it correctly, this should be an 8-digit number, okay? In base 10. Now, clearly, this can be represented as this first part times 10 to the 4 plus this second part. Okay? It's just another representation of the same number, where notice this is half of the number of digits we were using. Okay? And these here are now 4-digit numbers. Okay? So we can represent an 8-digit number with 2 4-digit numbers this way. We shall call this part the height part of the number. It's the most significant digits, and this part the lower part of the number. Okay? So in general, so for any base B, and for k being, let's say n half n, the floor of that, we have the following. A number A of n digits can be described as a high part times b to the k plus a low part, yeah. And for a number b, we can do the same. Okay. These are k-digit numbers. Okay, nothing strange so far. So now comes the following observation. Let's say we want to multiply I times B. We replace A and B by those identities. Okay, so this is the same as writing okay, the only thing I did was replace A and B by their representation using the higher part of A and the lower part of A and the higher part of B and the lower part of B. Now, what's this? This is some form of product of binomials, and we of course know how to solve it. We just multiply this by this and this by this and this by this and this by this and sum and regroup. Okay, so in the end, what we get is this times this times b to the 2k. We are also multiplying this with this plus, and now we have a combination: the higher part of a with the lower part of b plus the lower part of A times the higher part of B times B to the K plus the product of the lower parts. Okay, it's just simple rule we know from high school. So what? Well, observe. We are trying to solve this product. of n-digit numbers. And what this tells us is that we can solve it using 1, 2, 3, 4 products of 4-digit numbers, of numbers half as large, plus 1, 2, 3 additions. Okay, this is what this identity is suggesting. So this suggests a divide and conquer algorithm, okay, where we will split our input in half and try to solve the problem with that smaller parts. The algorithm looks more or less like this. Well, we split A and B into AH, AL, BH, BL. Okay? Just split each number in half. We recursively compute the products AH times BH, AH times BL, AL times BH, and AL times BL, which are the 4 products used here. And as a last step, we add these suitably aligned products. Right, so instead of multiplying by b to the 2k, we just align the numbers properly and just sum, okay, like we would do in school. Well, actually, there's something funny with this recursive algorithm. Anyone can spot it? So is there anything missing? So when do we stop? Yes? It's easy. There's always one H and one L, and we are using all the combinations everywhere. So. So here it says HH, HL, LH, LL. Is the rest all right or? Okay. But the idea of the pseudocode is okay. We first split them in half. We compute all the possible products recursively, and then we add appropriately using this identity. So what I think is missing is when we stop, right? And we should stop when we cannot divide these numbers in 2 parts, right? So if we have 1-digit numbers, we use primitive multiplication. Otherwise, we do all this. Okay? Is the idea of the algorithm clear. So I said when I introduced this recursive algorithm that we were going to do a recursive version of the school method. And when we look at this, it doesn't look like the school method at all, okay? But actually, it is essentially the school method. And there's a graphic way of looking at this, which is as follows. So let's consider this. What is this? Well, so let this thing here represent the number A, okay? And this represents when we do the school multiplication algorithms, we get lots of products by digits of B, and then we sum them, and they need to be somehow aligned. And this is the way the multiplication of each digit of B by A gets aligned. Okay, it's more or less a picture of the shape you get when you do the algorithm on paper. Okay, so essentially this row here corresponds to A times B0, the least significant digit of B. The second row corresponds to A times B1, suitably aligned, one place to the left, etc. Okay, so this shape here represents what we get in the school method when we do it on paper. And now let's divide it like this. And this portion here corresponds to AH and this one to AL, because if this here is the original number, then we have here the lower part and here the higher part. And this here represents BL and this here represents BH, because here is when we multiply A by the lowest digit of B and then the second lowest, etc. And if you look at it with enough love, you will realize that this here is AL times BL, and this here is AH times BL, and this here is AL times BH. No, sorry, I'm doing it. Yeah, it was okay. And this one is AH times BH. Why? Because, well, for instance, look at this. The first row we would have here corresponds to the row that results from multiplying this part of A, AH, by the first digit, the least significant digit of B. And that's why we are using BL here. And of course, then what we get is that this thing here is the way to align these sums to get the actual result. So with a little imagination, they are essentially the same algorithm. And the fact that they are the same algorithm, that we are doing the same numerical operations, maybe in another order, means that we should expect this algorithm to have the same complexity, to require the same number of primitive operations. So let's verify that. And in order to do that, we need to count the number of atomic operations, primitive operations, whatever we call them, in this recursive algorithm. And the question is, how do we count the numbers? Now it's not that easy because we have recursion in the middle. So, well, let's try something. So let this expression represent the maximum number of primitive operations required by the divide and conquer algorithm on n digit numbers. Okay, just giving a name for it and writing it for the posterity. So what can we say about this number? So what happens when n is 1? How many primitive operations do we need? Yes, 1. Very good. So 1 if n is 1. Because if n is 1, then we just use primitive multiplication. So what happens if n is 2 or more? Well, what do we know? We know that we are splitting all the numbers in half, okay? And what is the size in the worst case of these halves? So we could have rounding errors, and one half could be n over 2 minus 1, and the other one n minus 2, rounded up, something like that. So in the largest of the two halves will be at most size n over 2 rounded up, okay? So if n each half has size at most okay, so actually what we need to do in the recursive case is multiply four times numbers which are at most this high. Okay? So this tells us that we need 4 something like this. Well, but actually this is not precise because here we are approximating. Okay? I said in the worst case, each could be this, but maybe we are not in the worst case. So this, in fact, cannot be an equality. With this reasoning, it has to be an inequality. Okay, it could be this or smaller. In the case we are multiplying the half with n half n over 2, taking the lower part. Okay, and is that all? No, we need to also do some aligned sums, okay? Do you agree? In step 3, we still need to perform 3 sums, okay? So let's explain here. We take 4 products And then we need we need three sums, right? As witnessed by the question above. 1, 2, 3. How large could these sums be? How many digits are involved in the numbers being summed in each case? Well, if you multiply two numbers of n digits, you get a number with two n digits, right? So if you multiply two numbers with n over two digits, you get a number of n digits, okay? So each of the numbers we are adding there, rightly aligned, have n digits. And we know that adding n-digit numbers takes n primitive operations. So here we need a plus 3n. Yes.
Realistically, we need plus 3 because we could have two larger halves multiplied and they could be one larger than n.
Yeah, actually it's a little more tricky, so maybe we should go over the details. So actually what will go on is the following. We need to we need to add these two. This one we are sure, okay? This one takes n digits. And so what is actually going on is that you can have carry in each case. So here you can have so your point is whether we need to count the three additions or only one.
I think it is okay because you can take the middle one and then add it instead of adding it to the right.
So, okay, so this addition we need to do. Okay, so one we have for sure. This. I sort of got convinced when looking at this before that we actually need the other two because of there may be carry and then we need to do an addition of the carry, but now I don't see it clearly. Sorry, I would need to go step back. In any case, we have at most three sums, and we are looking for an upper bound, so it's okay. So, yeah, I leave the question where we actually need the three sums or only one would do, but yeah, it's a good point. Okay. So what we get here essentially is what we have just done is we got a little lemma and we did the proof. Okay, good. So now we have an expression that tells us, well, in this case it gives us an upper bound for the number of primitive operations that we need. What is the so? What is the question you should ask at this point? Well, so what? I mean, what is that strange recursive expression for the number of operations? Well, these kind of things are called recurrence equations. They appear extremely often when we try to count the number of operations, decide the complexity of a recursive algorithm, a divide and conquer algorithm. And in this form, they are essentially useless. Okay, I mean, we don't know how to read them or what to make of that. So now, as a magician, I will pull off a rabbit from my hat, okay? So just believe this for a moment. So this is a claim that I now make. I say, okay, if by looking at those recurrence equations with enough attention, I can somehow realize that these inequalities hold. So that this algorithm, this recursive version of the school method, we can say that it is quadratic as well as the iterative version. Maybe with worse constants, but since this is a model, we will ignore constants in general. For the sake of predictions, constants don't help. So now the key question, there are two questions here. Question number one, how do we prove these equivalences? Well, that part won't be that hard. We won't do it today, but it's essentially induction on N and using simple identities. So proving this will not be hard. The question is how does one come up with this in the first place? Okay? And the answer is that essentially one just guesses. I mean, it's not blind guessing. What one can do is start unfolding this recursive expression and doing some symbolic manipulation until one sees a pattern and says, oh, okay, now I think that this will be the right expression. And once you guess it, you prove it. We'll probably do that next class. And later, we will come to this master theorem, which was mentioned on Wednesday, which essentially gives us a tool to classify these recurrence equations and say, okay, if it looks more or less like this, then it corresponds to a quadratic function. If it looks like that, it corresponds to an exponential function, etc. Okay, so the proof comes later. But I mean, this is the key part of counting operations in recursive algorithms, what we do with that. Okay, we look at one last thing. There's a question here is, okay, we've looked at two multiplication algorithms, and both require a quadratic number of primitive operations to be solved, okay? Either by iteration or some crazy recursion or whatever, they need a quadratic number. Is that unavoidable? I mean, can we find some other algorithm that requires something less than quadratic? Well, the answer is surprisingly yes. It was thought for a time that the answer to this question was no, and that in fact this was a lower bound. But in the end of the 50s, a Russian mathematician or math student at that time, I'm not sure, came with this crazy algorithm that requires less than quadratic operations. And actually, given what we've seen so far, it's not that hard to see how it works. So this is called the Karatsuba, for the name of the Russian mathematician who developed it, Karatsuba multiplication. And the idea is the following. We just so we start with the identity we had there, okay? A times B equals that ugly thing below, which we use to derive the Karatsuba, sorry, the recursive algorithm. So we start with that identity. This was H times AL B to the 2K plus AH. Sorry, this is BH. I'm just writing nonsense. AHBH, AHBL plus ALBH times B to the K plus ALBL. Exactly the same what we got there. But then Karatsuba observed that this thing here, using simple algebraic identities like we use there, can be expressed in some other way. So this part is equivalent to another formula involving sums and multiplications, and it's something like this. So this part is the same. BH, B2K. But for this here, we can instead write it as follows. AH plus AL. So here it's A both times, and we have a sum in the middle. Times BH plus BL. And here we have the same thing. So Karatsuba's observation is that this thing here is exactly the same as this thing here, and you can verify it by yourself by just distributing the sum over the product and doing the simplifications. Oh no, wait, I missed a term, so this is not correct as it is. I was just looking at it and he said, this is impossible. I mean, there's too many terms. So yeah, we need to subtract. AH BH plus AL BL. Horrible. Right. So again, we won't do it, but you can check it by yourself. Just expand this, subtract this, and you will get exactly this. Okay? And now again, so what? This is horribly complex. We seem to be in a worse situation than before. But now, notice this. How many multiplications do we have here? Well, it's worse than before. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 multiplications, worse than before. But how many distinct multiplications do we have? Because look, this multiplication here is essentially the one we need to use here. And this multiplication here is essentially the one we needed to use here anyway. So how many distinct multiplications we have? Well, we have 1, 2, and 3, instead of 4 before. We now have more additions and one subtraction, which you need to believe me that behaves in terms of complexity like addition. You just remember the school method and it's the same method as addition. So we have one multiplication less, but more additions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So is there anything to gain? Well, since we know from the results from Wednesday that multiplication is much more expensive than addition, maybe we actually win if we trade one multiplication for three additions. So that's the essential idea. From this we get a simple recursive algorithm like the one we had there. Which looks, let's write it. So Karasuba algorithm looks like this. So again, we split A and B in half. Then we compute the three relevant products. And finally, we compute the result, which is pH Okay, I've just made explicit the fact that we first pre-compute these products and we save it and reuse them here. Again, we are missing the base case. Okay, so when do we stop the recursion? Well, here is more problematic because this product here can have, I mean, each of these can have n over 2 plus 1 digits, because when we do this sum here, we might be getting one more digit from the carry. Okay, so this number is slightly more complex than before, but what this means is that recursion terminates, I mean recursion decreases, let's say, if this number so here when we do the recursive call we need to be sure that this thing decreases, okay, and this happens if n is at least 4. So if n is at it, n is less than 4, then we use the school method. And otherwise, we do all this. So again, we can compute we can estimate the maximum number of primitive operations for the Karabtsova algorithm. Yes? Recursion decreases if this condition holds, because here in this recursive call, the size of the arguments could be as large as this. So in order to guarantee that it decreases, the value of the number of digits, we need to guarantee that. So we can compute now a bound for the number of operations, and this follows exactly the same idea we did for the case of the recursive algorithm, and the result we will get now is that instead of 1 for the base case, we are using the school method, so we need to use the value on the second theorem, so that will give us 3n squared plus 2n if n is less or equal than 3. And otherwise, well, we already discussed this. We have 3 multiplications. Each has size Sorry, let me use K for Karatsuba. That's the same. So each multiplication involves numbers of at most n over 2 plus 1. A little more complex because first we summed here. And then we have 6 additions or subtractions over numbers that can have at most n digits. Numbers on. And what we will see next class is that actually now we have another recurrence equation. I don't know, it looks similar to the one before. It has another coefficients, but in this case we get, for instance, that and this looks more crazy. So for this recurrence equation, we can first guess and then prove that this is at most 207 times n to the logarithm in base 2 of 3. How we will get to that is seems surprising at this point. And what we know is that this number is approximately 1.58. OK? So this algorithm is better than quadratic. It's n to the 1.6 or something like that. Does it make a difference? Well, for large enough numbers, yes. So I think if you try to make an implementation of this simple algorithm as it is, you will get that it behaves better for, say, n equals 1,000. OK, that may happen. But in practice, what you need to do is tune up this limit here. And maybe if you experiment with different values, with larger values, so if you switch to the school method before something around 20 or 30, then you get that this works always better than the school multiplication. And in fact, if you look at some implementation of a library for arbitrary precision numbers like Big Decimal in Java or GMP or whatever, if they don't use Karatsuba algorithm, they will use some variation also based in these identities and for which the theoretical complexity is n to the and some number below 2. Okay, that's all for today. Until Wednesday, where you will be again with Professor Schroeder.